Dr. Flato, welcome to this special podcast of Science Friday from sciencefriday.com. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. Anyone who knows me realizes that I suffer from namnesia. I'm sure you've heard it on the air. I routinely forget the names of my guests, but of course I have little voices in my ear that bail me out. When something like that happens, of course, I'm always wondering, does this mean I'm losing my memory? Am I getting Alzheimer's? Am I getting some other kind of dementia? Well, Aaron Nelson is the co-author with Susan Gilbert of the Harvard Medical School Guide to Achieving Optimal Memory, and he has some reassuring news. We may be forgetful, but most of us are not losing our memory. In fact, there are ways to make it better. Dr. Nelson is chief of neuropsychology in the Division of Cognitive and Behavioral Neurology at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's also assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Med School in Boston, and he joins us today from the studios of member station WBUR. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Nelson.
Thanks for having me on, Ira.
See, they're ready to forget your name already. I mean, my mother, who is 94 years old, God bless her, has said that she hasn't been able to remember names for 50 years. I mean, maybe I'm inheriting that from her or something. This is a common thing not to remember people's names?
Yeah, it's probably one of the top five common complaints that people come with. You use the term namnesia. There's also roomnesia, which is walking into a room and sort of forgetting what the heck you were doing there. There's episodic fleeting thought disorder, which is being in the middle of a conversation and kind of losing your train of thought. Does that sound familiar?
What?
exactly. You've got it. And then there's
That could be a killer in my business, losing your train of thought.
That's right. There's parking lot displacement. This is where, you know, losing your car in the mall, that's probably number four. And then there's the paroxysmal anavigationalism. That's sort of forgetting your exit on the highway. So those are the top five things that people complain about. And usually they're benign.
How about house keys amnesia, car key amnesia? People can't remember where they left those things.
Yeah, those are in the top 10.
You know, I know why that is, actually. I actually figured out why you can't remember where your keys are.
Tell me.
Because you never see where you put them down.
That's right.
You drop them on the counter, you're not even seeing. So, you know, if I have a little tool, I look at my hand where the key is, and I put it down, and I have never forgotten where it is because I actually see where I left it.
Yeah.
You know, you're carrying all those groceries and you drop them down, you don't know where you left it.
Yeah. As Yogi Berra said, I think 90% of memory is attention. So if you're focused on what you're doing at the moment, there's a much better chance you're going to remember what you did later on. And having a set place for things really does work. The car keys are always in the same place.
So at what point do you need to be concerned about your memory?
Well, the kind of things that we've been talking about so far are pretty typical. They're benign. They don't necessarily pretend any kind of scary illness or disease. But when you have someone who's beginning to forget more core information, for example, about themselves or their family, the name of a grandchild, some specific piece of information about where they worked for 20 years, that kind of a thing, this sort of forgetting is a bit more worrisome. Typically, people with more worrisome kinds of memory problems are not the ones who seek help. It's usually someone related to them, a spouse, a family member.
I see, who alerts them to this.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. That's not always the case. I mean, there are certainly a minority of people who I see, patients who I see in the office, who are in fact aware of what turns out to be the very beginning of a disease process.
And is there a typical age where you start noticing this, or is it run the gamut?
Yeah. Well, in normal aging, in terms of if I could use that word, and that's a kind of a controversial term, normal aging, but in normal or usual aging, there are measurable changes in memory function that are actually evident even in the 30s and 40s. But in terms of pathological changes in memory, of course, the most common being Alzheimer's disease, this is typically has onset of symptoms in the late 60s and early 70s. Mm-hmm. There are some much rarer genetic variants with an earlier onset, but those are really just a very small fraction of the overall disease.
Talking with Dr. Aaron Nelson, author of the Harvard Medical Guide, the Harvard Med School Guide to Achieving Optimal Memory, co-authored with Susan Gilbert. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's talk about some of the mythology or some of the truth behind things that might cause you to forget stuff. For example, we live in a very stressful world. I've been told that stress can wreck your short-term memory. Is that true?
Too much stress can. Actually, at very high and sustained levels, stress has, we know, can cause actual physical and physiologic damage to structures in the brain that are important for memory. But at mild or moderate levels, stress actually can help memory function, believe it or not, because it kind of alerts you. It gets you to pay attention to something. It gets you to sort of label an event or an experience as important and worth remembering. Too much stress, obviously sustained stress, can actually damage limbic structures within the brain.
Mm. How about not getting a good night's sleep, and habitually, you know, because you snore or wake up or things like that, you really never really get a good night's sleep. Can that really affect your memory?
Absolutely. Sleep is critical for what we call consolidation, which is a process by which memory is etched into storage. And there's been some fascinating research by some of my colleagues at the medical school that looks at, and I think actually you had Bob Stickle on at one point,
right,
who looks at the role of sleep in learning and consolidation across time. The other, I think you were mentioning snoring, that brings to mind obstructive sleep apnea, which is a very common and underdiagnosed condition that can fragment sleep and cause decreased daytime alertness. And again, you get that kind of a front-end problem with memory, mm-hmm, where people are just not as attentive, don't absorb things, and therefore don't remember them as well.
Mm-hmm. Another thing we hear a lot about, more people now are aware of their parents or grandparents having Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. Does that mean you're going to automatically get it yourself?
Not at all. In fact, the majority of Alzheimer's disease is sporadic. It doesn't have at least an obvious genetic connection or familial connection. Certainly having a relative with Alzheimer's disease does increase your risk, but it's not anything like the type of genetic determination that we see with other illnesses. The genetics of Alzheimer's disease are extremely complex. We don't really have it worked out yet, but at this point, having a relative with Alzheimer's disease is not absolutely seal your destiny as having it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. John in Louisiana. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
How you doing? I had a question about anxiety. I'm a student at Louisiana State University, and I noticed that with my anxiety, it affects my covert and overt behavior, whether it be thinking or behaving using motor skills. Could you comment on that, please?
Well, I mean, anxiety, this sort of goes along with what we're talking about with stress, John. Anxiety is an internal event which is going to distract you. It's going to take your focus off whatever it is you're trying to focus on at the time. If you're anxious and your mind keeps sort of fleeing to some anxiety-laden thought that you're kind of compulsively replaying, you're not focusing on what's in front of you. You're not absorbing it, and therefore you're not going to remember it.
Mm-hmm. Are there any things you can do to improve your memory?
Well, there's lots of things you can do, Ira. In fact, roughly speaking, about 50% of how your memory changes with age is not genetically determined, which means that it's really within your control. It has to do with behaviors, habits, things you do in your life that can make a substantial impact on how things go for you. What we've learned about memory really is echoes a lot of what we learned about cardiovascular health in terms of brain health. And it turns out that everything that we know that's good for the brain, is good for the heart, is also good for the brain. So promoting optimal diet, exercise, managing stress, these things will all help ensure brain health as we age. There are other things I think I talk about in my book in terms of habits that you can devise or strategies that you can come up with that can effectively deal with certain repetitive memory problems in your everyday life. There's been some interesting research out of Columbia over the last 20 years on what's called cognitive reserve. Here the notion is that being involved in lifelong learning and keeping intellectually engaged makes a difference. It certainly can push off the onset of Alzheimer's disease. We know that people with high levels of cognitive reserve can resist symptoms of Alzheimer's disease despite an equal or greater amount of brain pathology than people with the low levels of cognitive reserve. And this all has to do with both genetic and acquired intellectual interests.
We've heard stories about studies with people who do crossword puzzles or mental exercises having better memory functions as they get older.
Well,
is that true?
There's some evidence. Again, there's a lot of evidence about ongoing intellectual engagement, which speaks to that. Whatever it is for you, something that engages your interest, something that engages your creativity, whether it's learning something new, getting involved in a project that puts you in contact with new learning, new people, these are all things that are going to promote that kind of lifelong intellectual engagement, which is important. Crossword puzzles, sure, why not? I think that there's a little bit of overselling of that kind of a I think there was there's some you see a lot of techniques that are kind of one-shot sorts of things. If you try and remember a particular article of clothing that somebody's wearing every morning that you wake up, something new, that's going to improve your memory. Well, I'm not quite going along with that. I think it's really more of a longitudinal kind of a habitual engagement in learning. That makes a difference.
Yeah. What about food and food supplements like vitamins, things like that?
Yeah, vitamins are important. Certainly, there's some good evidence that certain kinds of vitamins, particularly the B vitamins, for example, have a important link with how memory goes as we age. B vitamins are – you can't obtain these are not produced from within. You have to actually get them through food, through supplements. Those are important. And certainly there are vitamin deficiencies, certain kinds of B vitamin deficiencies, which can produce severe memory problems. So that's critical. And often one of the things we look for in patients presenting with memory complaints, we want to have a good idea of what their nutritional status is, what they're eating, maybe what they're missing, supplementing things. It's important.
1-800-989-8255. Thomas in Ann Arbor. Hi, Thomas.
Hello. I'm calling in to ask if you could... Pardon me. I'm calling in to ask if you could explain why, with my own experience with memory, that any events in my life that I have an emotional involvement with, either positive or negative, seem to be more easily fixed in my mind. And even when I'm reading literature, if I have positive or negative opinions about what I'm reading, the literature that I read is more easily fixed in my mind.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And we're talking.
Sure.
Go ahead, Dr. Nelson. We all have that certain things like, where you were when the Kennedy assassination or 9/11 or something like that, what you were doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What you're referring to just now, Ira, has to do with what we call flashbulb memories. But the caller was talking about more personal memories that are emotionally tinged. These are things that events that are important in our lives that really capture our attention at the time that they're occurring. And information which is important, which is emotionally significant, is always going to be remembered more soundly across time. It's going to be etched into our memories more deeply. And there's actually an anatomic reason for this to some degree. We have structures in the brain that are important for memory and the experience of motion that are really overlap. so that there's a lot of crosstalk between these structures. In terms of flashbulb memories, one of the interesting things, you mentioned the Kennedy assassination. That's been studied recently. There's been some interesting research on the 9/11 disaster, looking at people's memory for those events. And even though in some ways there's an enduring memory for the event, they're also subject to the same kinds of biases and changes over time that normal memories are. That's what's kind of fascinating. So what remains is this absolute conviction of remembering a particular detail. But when you actually look at the data, it turns out that it might not be quite as accurate as you think.
Mm-hmm. And we're finding memories are not very accurate, especially in court cases and things like that.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of research over the past 30 to 40 years on what happens in eyewitness testimony. And this is very important because eyewitness testimony has always been given the kind of the gold standard for evidence in criminal cases. And eyewitness testimony is remarkably influenceable by really sort of subtle events that happen, or the way a question is asked by whether it's somebody that's investigating a crime or trying to take an account of a crime scene can influence the way somebody remembers something with the subtlest kind of information.
Now we've run out of time. I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us and joining us on Friday.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much. Talking with Dr. Aaron Nelson, Assistant Professor of Psychology at Harvard Med School and author of The Harvard Medical School Guide to Achieving Optimal Memory. Thanks for joining us again today. One last personal note before we go on the passing of astrophysicist John Bacall, who died peacefully in New York on Wednesday after suffering from a rare blood disorder. Though he was one of the most respected men in his field, having published over 500 books, papers, and articles in five generations, Dr. Bacall was one of the rare scientists who did not shy away from the public spotlight. When he believed in an idea like, let's say, the Hubble Space Telescope, he found time to hurry to Washington to rally support. He was also a willing teacher who could be found at the Institute for Advanced Studies lunch table conducting a seminar over soup and sandwiches, or patiently answering the naive questions of we journalists. And we used to put a lot to him. His humor, his wisdom, and his generosity will be sorely missed, and our condolences go out to his wife, Netta, and the family. Thanks for listening. If you think Science Friday is good online, check us out on the air. Visit sciencefriday.com for a list of public radio stations that carry Science Friday on the radio. I'm Ira Flatow. We'll see you next time.